Welcome to Home Ground. I'm Brian Kahn. We humans establish boundaries. We claim ownership and territory, build fences and walls. Sometimes they're physical, sometimes economic or political. Over 50 years ago, our government built such a wall around the island of Cuba. In its essentials, it's still there. For example, it remains a federal felony for American citizens to travel to Cuba without permission from our government. But ducks, hummingbirds, sharks, and even oil spills do not recognize this wall. They move back and forth through it, and in doing so, create shared risks and interests for both countries. The Environmental Defense Fund understands this and has been building bridges instead of walls. Dan Whittle is EDF's Cuba Program Director. Dan, many thanks for joining us on Home Ground.
Thank you, Brian. Nice to be here.
Where'd you grow up? What'd your folks do?
I grew up in western Kentucky in a small farm town, and my dad was a country lawyer and a small farmer. Spent several years there before moving to New Hampshire. My parents divorced, moved to the coast of New Hampshire, and when I first got my first taste of the ocean and the outdoors. Spent a lot of time in the White Mountains of New Hampshire, and then when I was in college back in Tennessee, I spent a lot of time in East Tennessee in the Smokies. Have never looked back, have always been drawn to the outdoors, especially to the ocean, and have made my life out of it.
When you say drawn to, that's something personal. What is it that draws you to the ocean?
Well, when I was a kid, 7 years old, we used to go fishing off the small coast of New Hampshire, and I was sure I wanted to be a lobster fisherman. And in high school, I was lucky enough to get certified as a diver, a scuba diver, and had, you know, a quarter-inch wetsuit, full gear, dove off the coast of New Hampshire. Visibility was about 4 feet. I saw a flounder and a lobster. You know, I froze my butt off. I needed to recalibrate and figure out what my relationship with the ocean would be. I wasn't sure at that point that being a lobster fisherman was my best bet. But I, you know, ended up going to law school. I was a guide in Alaska for a couple years. Spent a lot of time, you know, rafting and fishing. And then after law school, I came back to the East Coast and eventually ended up at Environmental Defense working on oceans issues.
All right, why conservation? Some people that are interested in the ocean might end up fishing. You're working in ocean conservation. Why?
When I worked in Alaska, I was exposed to the conflict between those who wanted to use the land for economic development and those who wanted to conserve the land. And there was a tension in Alaska. There's a tension in East Tennessee. Really, there's a tension wherever there's you know, big expanses of land and resources. I was drawn to be part of striking the right balance, and the politics really also attracted me as well. I became politicized in college because of the acid rain problem, and just wanted to be a part of trying to, you know, solve those problems.
When you say strike the right balance, there's an implication in what you're saying that there is a balance between human use, protection of the natural ecosystems or something, but it seems to recognize the legitimacy of human use. Am I reading too much into the phrase?
No, that's absolutely right. I grew up on a cattle farm, and in North Carolina, I worked significantly with hog farmers to try to figure out how to do a better job of raising farms at a large scale without polluting the environment, without causing runoff to North Carolina rivers and bays. Once I began working with these farmers, I realized that they have a legitimate concern. Their families have been there for generations, and there's absolutely no reason we can't have clean rivers, clean bays, and hog production, healthy farms.
How long have you been with the Environmental Defense Fund?
I started with Environmental Defense Fund, EDF, in 1997, so I'm approaching my 17th year.
And what have you done over the course of that time in summary form?
I was the office attorney in the North Carolina office. I've worked on clean air. I've worked on clean water. I've worked on factory hog farms. I was the Southeast Oceans Director, meaning we addressed overfishing from North Carolina to Florida. And since 2000, I've been working in Cuba to advance conservation in Cuba, both to preserve Cuban biodiversity, but also the shared resources, the shared ocean waters that unite us.
We're going to talk about that in depth, but it's interesting to hear an organization called Environmental Defense Fund employed you to work on hog farms. Now, we don't have time to go into the whole issue, but a lot of the people in our listening audience are aware of the controversy around what I'll call factory hog farms. What was EDF's interest, and in summary, how did you work it out or work it through on hog farms?
As the North Carolina office of EDF, we were focused on the major environmental problems of the day. In the late 90s and early 2000s, factory hog farms were growing at an incredible rate. North Carolina is the second largest hog producer in the nation, next to Iowa, and these hog farms were proliferating at a rate that was wreaking havoc on neighbors and causing fish kills and massive water pollution and groundwater contamination. And so we stepped up to try to figure out how we could address that problem politically and by working with the farmers themselves.
What kind of reaction did you get from the farmers? Who the heck are you guys trying to take away our livelihood, or did you end up getting cooperation or what?
Well, at first we were just dealing with the big companies, Smithfield Foods, the ones who essentially control the scene. One day I walked into my office and I found 2 6-foot-4 hog farmers waiting for me. And at first I was going to jump behind the desk, but they were private, individual, family farmers who wanted to build a bridge between environmentalists and the industry, much to the industry's dismay, I may say. But these farmers took the leadership to work with environmentalists, which was something new. And after that, we came up with solutions to make hog farms cleaner, safer, and to make them still economically viable.
I think it's a good time for me to read the mission of your organization, which frankly struck me when I read it. Environmental Defense Fund is dedicated to protecting the environmental rights of all people, including the right to clean air, clean water, healthy food, and flourishing ecosystems. Guided by science, we work to create practical solutions that win lasting political, economic, and social support because they're nonpartisan, cost-effective, and fair. I was quite actually surprised and taken aback to see such clarity of statement reflecting the what I would say it seems to me implicit in this is the necessary synergy between good science, people's environmental rights — we often don't talk about rights in that context — and practical solutions, meaning work politically and economically for people. What's your experience been with how seriously the mission's taken? It may be easy to put it on paper, but your hog example suggests, at least in some cases, it's taken seriously.
Well, Brian, you know, there are dozens of ways to go about environmental protection. One of them is conflict. And we started out by litigating. We were trying to protect the osprey population in Long Island from DDT. We essentially sued to eliminate the use of DDT in pesticides. You know, we've had countless lawsuits over the year, countless confrontations, but we found that the most effective approach is to recognize the economic driver behind behavior, acknowledge that in most cases that economic driver, like family farming in North Carolina, is a legitimate interest, and sit down at the table and try to reconcile environmental concerns with those economic interests. And almost all the time it works. It works in clean air. In 1990, we were behind the Clean Air Act amendments, came up with a system where much more flexible system for reducing sulfur dioxide. We've seen dramatic decreases in sulfur dioxide pollution. We're doing the same thing with carbon, working with companies to reduce their carbon footprint, from Walmart to Duke Energy and others. So we're seeing that you can get change a lot faster in a manner that benefits more people if you have the approach reflected in our mission statement.
You're listening to Home Ground, and I'm Brian Kahn. We're talking with Dan Whittle, Environmental Defense Fund's Cuba Program Director. I'm looking at an article called Bridging the Gulf, Finding Common Ground on Environmental and Safety Preparedness for Offshore Oil and Gas in Cuba. What's the story of your organization's involvement in this issue?
For several years, the Cuban government has been hoping to exploit oil off their northwest coast in the Gulf of Mexico. And that's caused great concern in the U.S., primarily because if there's a major oil spill in Cuban waters, it will affect southeast Florida and the southeast United States. That's been the concern. In 2010, when the BP oil spill occurred, suddenly everyone realized that Cuba was at risk because of an oil spill in U.S. waters. The U.S. and Cuba don't talk. There's not diplomatic relations.
When you say they don't talk, now I know you're involved in this for some time now. How full is don't talk? I mean, it sounds kind of odd to hear it said. What does it mean, don't talk?
Well, you know, that's a great question. The U.S. and Cuba do not have diplomatic relations.
Okay.
So people have to tie themselves into knots in order to communicate with their counterparts in the Cuban government. So, for example, when the oil started spilling from the BP oil rig, Deepwater Horizon, the Cuban government, the Coast Guard, the environmental agencies could not communicate directly with the U.S. Coast Guard, Department of Interior, or EPA. But they had to go through the State Department, which is a very slow bureaucratic process. So what did they do instead? They came to Environmental Defense Fund. They called us up and they said, can you please send us as much information every day as you can on the spill so we can be prepared? Now, eventually, the State Department, the U.S. State Department, and their Cuban counterpart opened channels of communication so the two governments could begin sharing information. But it was a slow process, and they had no experience of doing it, so the individuals didn't know each other. So.
And high stakes, arguably.
And extremely high stakes. So fast forward to 2012, when the Cubans are very eager to explore for oil off of their coast. And remember, the Deepwater Horizon was an exploratory rig. Major oil spill during the exploration phase.
I didn't remember that. I thought it was a functioning oil well, but it was during the exploratory phase.
Exploratory. So when Cuba was beginning to drill with a Spanish oil company called Repsol in early 2012, the Environmental Defense Fund was working with an industry group, the International Association of Drilling Contractors, which focuses on drilling safety. We partnered. Environmental group, industry group partnered to call upon the U.S. government to facilitate exchange between U.S. and Cuba, specifically to allow private oil spill response companies to respond to an oil spill in Cuban waters in time to prevent that oil from damaging U.S. coast.
Now, the Cubans, from what I've read, and it's not my specialty, but they've had several major exploratory wells drilled over the last several years.
That's true.
And they're energy deficient in the sense that they consume a lot more oil. They get their oil from Venezuela. They consume a lot more oil than they produce on the island. So that's part of the pressure for them to find oil. They're going to pursue this, I assume.
That's correct. They produce about a third of their needs and import two-thirds from Venezuela.
Okay, so an average person would say, gee, an oil spill in either American waters or Cuban waters is a threat to everybody. Government should work it out. That seems fairly common sense. You're saying even now, in the aftermath of the BP spill, that's not the case? Somebody hasn't picked up the phone and said, yeah, let's just cut through the red tape and make something happen here that makes sense for everybody?
We've made good progress since 2012. In 2012, we were making the case that the two governments need to talk to each other for that specific reason. The good news is that President Obama's oil spill commission came out with a recommendation on page 300 saying the U.S. and Cuba need to cooperate. Environmental Defense Fund took the co-chair of that group, Bill Riley, former EPA administrator under the first Bush president. We took him to Cuba, and basically he came back from Cuba with his eyes open saying, the Cuban government is motivated to do things right, and we have to work with them to make sure they've got the wherewithal to do so. Shortly after that, the White House initiated talks with Cuba, Mexico, and other countries in the region to facilitate cooperation on oil. So as we stand today, there are ongoing dialogues on how to work together if there is an oil spill. More needs to be done, but we're making good progress because, as you indicated, this is an environmental issue, not a political issue. It's in our interest to work together. And so I'm happy to report there has been some progress, and progress, frankly, that could open up avenues on other issues.
Let's probe that a little bit. Going back to your mission statement, you look for practical solutions with lasting political, economic, and social support. Mm. In fact, just about anything related to dealing with Cuba is political. There's a longstanding, obviously, animosity from Cuban Americans who've come to the United States, certainly the original generations. Memories are long. It's common knowledge that efforts to reestablish any sort of normalization run into strong resistance. You can argue one side or the other. So has there been any negative response, let's say, from that part of the Cuban-American community or their representatives in Congress that is sort of negative to your work on the oil spill? Or is it so common sense people say, well, that's an exception to what would be otherwise a logical rule of isolation?
There has been very little opposition to what we're doing. In fact, the former governor of Florida, former U.S. Senator Bob Graham, who historically was in favor of restrictions on Cuba, has come out in favor of engagement with Cuba on this issue. He's a very influential person still in Florida. In fact, Bob Graham and I and Bill Riley and others went down to Cuba this January and again came back with the same message. It's in Florida's interest. I haven't met a single politician in South Florida who opposes engagement on the oil issue. Despite occasional noise from lobbyists, this is an issue where almost all parties agree we have to work together.
Another article I'm looking at is from Scientific American, How to Save Sharks Off Cuba's Coast and in the Gulf of Mexico. Now, our species has a mixed relationship with sharks. I can think immediately of Jaws, and on the other hand, as a layman, I know that sharks around the world are being hammered, overfished, and potentially in jeopardy of extinction in some cases. First, why should people care about sharks?
Worldwide, about 90% of the shark populations have gone away. We're seeing a massive problem in terms of overfishing with respect to sharks worldwide. In the Gulf of Mexico alone, we've seen a dramatic decline in shark populations in Mexico, U.S., and Cuba. And many of those shark species travel freely between the three countries. Shark populations in Cuba account for about one-fifth of the species, of the shark species. So Cuba has a number of species which are important to the U.S., Mexico, and other countries.
When you say important, what, just from an ecological standpoint, they're an apex predator, what difference does it make if sharks are wiped out? In scientific terms, ecological terms, the health of the fishery?
Sharks are kind of like the wolves of Yellowstone. The wolves in Yellowstone serve a very important role in the ecosystem. So in order for ecosystems to function, you have to keep the apex predators like sharks a part of it. Healthy coral reefs in Cuba depend upon healthy and abundant shark populations, just as healthy ecosystems in the West and in Yellowstone depend upon having the wildlife, all of the wildlife there, including the apex predators like the wolves. So it's critical as we move forward. For any of your listeners who have not been to Cuba and have not seen the stunning coral reefs there, Cuba is home to the richest biodiversity in the region and the most beautiful coral reefs. Without the sharks, those go away.
I was reading something that said sharks eat other predatory fish, sort of like the way wolves reduce the coyote population. And so if you have sharks feeding on some of these other predatory fish, smaller life forms flourish, whereas if the sharks aren't there, that intermediary predator, a la the coyote, expands its population and dramatically alters the balance of life forms.
That's exactly true. The entire food chain is critical. If you have too many groupers who don't have sharks as a predator, they eat too many parrotfish. Parrotfish aren't eating the algae on the corals. The coral suffers as a result.
So what do you do about it? What's EDF doing in relation to sharks in Cuba?
Well, the only way to protect sharks in the Gulf of Mexico is for the three countries to work together. So first, we need better science. There's very little data on the health of sharks in Cuban and Mexico waters. So we're working with scientists in both countries to improve that data. How are we doing that? We're working with fishermen in the town of Cojimar. That's where Hemingway parked his boat.
Rings a bell.
Was just there last week, met with these old-timers who remember when fishermen before them caught the world's biggest great white shark, landed it in Cojimar. They don't see sharks that big anymore.
Wow.
So we have to work with them. We're working with them to record their landings. We've also found that in that part of Cuba, they have a nursery. We believe they have a nursery for oceanic white-tipped sharks, a species that's almost gone in U.S. waters. So the trick is to improve the science, and then get the managers in the three countries to start talking to each other to develop strategies to involve fishermen, especially on how to bring those populations back.
You're listening to Home Ground, and I'm Brian Kahn. We're talking with Environmental Defense Fund Cuba Program Manager Dan Whittle. I think you just said you got to get the science, and then you're going to talk with fishermen about what to do with the science. Now, these are folks who have inadvertently, I assume, participated in over-harvesting the sharks. They depend on their livelihood for being able to fish. What do you think the chances are you can work out an agreement, as you did with the hog farmers, to say, let's change practices, because these folks depend for a living on catching fish?
Well, fishermen in Cuba have been around for a long time, and they know what's going on. If you look at the fishing fleet in Cuba, it's old, it's antiquated. You don't see the modern technology of boats in the U.S., but Cuban fishermen are very, very good. I went out on a tuna boat last year, and the tuna fishermen look for the birds. The birds are following the fish. The sharks and the tuna swim together. They're all feeding. So in that case, the fishermen depend upon healthy shark populations to lead them to the tuna, which they catch in great numbers with bamboo rods and just their eyesight. So Cuban fishermen are capable of catching a great many fish, even with old technology or lack thereof, and they're worried. They don't see the big fish they used to see in many parts. In several of the marine parks in Cuba, they're seeing, you know, the big Goliath groupers, the big fish, but outside the borders, they're not seeing as many, and they're worried. So they want to come up with new strategies. At the same time, the economy's not in great shape in Cuba. People have to put food on the table, right. So there's a real incentive to continue fishing.
I just have to say, when you're talking about Cuban fishermen being good, it took me back to Hemingway's Old Man and the Sea.
Yeah.
And that guy who was based on a real fisherman that
Gregorio.
Hemingway knew well. He was good, very good. The implication of what you're saying, correct me if I'm wrong, is that you have Cuban fishermen who want to talk, who are interested in science, and the potential of modifying their practices to restore a better fishery at the same time maintaining their ability to earn a living. Fair summary?
Absolutely.
Our sense for Cuban structure, because it is a Communist Party-run state, is that everyday people don't really interact in discussions of policy at the level you're talking about. One of the articles I have, which surprised me about your organization, is titled People on the Planet, Cuba's Fishing Communities Fight Hardships with Sustainable Practices. The thrust of the article is you guys are involved in what I will call on-the-ground discussions about evolving policy alternatives and sustainable practices with people in everyday sort of fishing community villages. Am I misreading this? Because it's a surprise in terms of my expectations.
No, that's absolutely, Brian. One thing we've learned in the U.S. is you can be successful in ending overfishing unless fishermen are involved. Fishermen historically have always found ways around the rules. Unless you bring them to the table and provide incentives to fish more sustainably, you simply aren't going to succeed. We've learned that in the U.S., and we now have fishery management programs that are extremely inclusive, essentially co-management. You're getting fishermen to be part of the science gathering and part of the management. Same thing applies in Cuba. The government realizes that in order to address this serious problem, fishermen have to be part of the solution. So we've begun working with the Cuban government and some Cuban environmental organizations to work in two fishing communities to solicit fishermen involvement, fishermen ideas on how to get things right. Fishermen in these two communities would like to form cooperatives, would like to band together, be part of the science, the management. So I've been to a couple meetings recently, and the schoolhouse is packed with fishermen, fisherwomen, children, grandparents, community leaders, etc. It's an extremely participatory setting, and fishermen, they're extremely motivated and delighted to be part of the conversation, which historically they haven't been part of the management discussion. Now that's changing.
You indicate the Cuban government is supportive. I've done a fair amount of facilitative work with hierarchical organizations like the Forest Service, and I would just say in relation to the Forest Service, involving loggers and environmentalists and people of the community in developing management recommendations for a long time was a tough sell because they think, hey, wait a minute, we're professional silviculturalists, we're the experts. I would expect that potentially in spades in Cuba. What's your experience with the attitude of the government toward this kind of work?
The government has been extremely receptive to Environmental Defense Fund. Why? Because we are grounded in science. We have got lots of experience, not just in the U.S., but in Mexico and around the globe in carving out practical solutions to the same problems that they have. So in a way, we add capacity, and we've been working there for 14 years. Hmm. I'd like to think we're a trusted partner in Cuba, and they know that we're prepared to work with them, not against them.
And how about the dynamics of the local community? You made, I think, a critically important point that local people involved in resource industries have knowledge. Often, my experience is knowledge that sometimes specialists don't have who are sitting behind desks looking at data. Can you give any examples of input from local people that you think is helpful toward moving in the direction of a sustainable fishery in Cuba?
Well, yes. In our first meeting in the communities, we interviewed a lot of old-timers, and they described the fish they used to catch. And historically, the fish were much bigger. The reef fish, the snappers, the groupers, than they are now. So that's an indication that something's out of balance, something's not working. So one solution there is to identify areas, spawning areas, and other areas, important habitats, where these areas can be set aside to protect these populations. So they grow back, and then as they grow, they spill over into the areas that can be fished. And that's a concept, it's called marine protected area, that the fishermen believe in, because they've seen it work in the Gardens of the Queen, which is this fantastic marine park off the south coast of Cuba. They've seen if you protect an area, it benefits fishermen down the road.
You raise an issue that I hadn't thought of in terms of protected areas. My understanding is Cuba has a pretty extensive network of protected areas reflecting a conservation ethic. Is that fair, or am I misinformed?
Cuba is a world leader in protecting marine areas, marine coral reefs, mangroves, and seagrasses, all essential to fish reproduction. They are striving to protect 25% of their marine platform, which is a humongous number, and they're making great progress toward that number. So they are truly a world leader.
You pointed out their economy is not in great shape. I think the number one industry is tourism. It's expanding rapidly. Some people I know in Cuba express concern that with more tourism, some of these fragile coastal resources may become in jeopardy from overuse and development. What's your sense for that, and what's your sense for EDF's potential role?
Tourism is a huge economic savior in Cuba. The government is actively trying to develop coastal tourism. It's also one of the greatest risks. So the challenge is really to strike the right balance, to make sure facilities are not in key habitat areas. That's where the marine protected area system comes in. You protect those areas, but also you have to have decent rules where hotels are built far enough back. You're not building golf courses that overextend the aquifer, et cetera. I'm optimistic. I believe the Cuban government and its scientists and its environmental groups understand the challenge, and I think they're up for it. They really have an opportunity to be more like a Costa Rica when it comes to protecting your environment versus other areas of the Caribbean who, frankly, have sacrificed their environment for short-term economic development that tourism brings. But it's a huge challenge.
Dan Whittle, I very much regret to say we're out of time. I want to thank you so much for being with us on Home Ground. And to our listeners, many thanks for being with us. We hope you'll join us next week. Home Ground is an independent production of Artemis Common Ground and does not necessarily reflect the views of this radio station. Post-production by Valtron Recording Studios. We welcome your ideas for new programs at www.homegroundradio.org. Home Ground is made possible by grants from the Liz Claiborne Art Ortenberg Foundation, Cinnabar Foundation, Humanities Montana, and the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication about issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans.